Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week with Dr. T, our weekly news program. It's posted every Monday morning at 11 a.m. I hope you're able to watch this one on with us live on 11 a.m., but it's available for you to watch it on all the places that we live cast, particularly on Rumble and Telegram and X, at your convenience, wherever you want to watch it. It's also, we have a large channel over on Cloud Hub that have all of our podcasts that go back several years. So I hope that you'll join it, and I hope by now you've joined our new Tenpenny Prime membership. There are three educational content programs that benefit you specifically. A topical write paper that I write myself. I just finished the one for next month. It's about 20 pages. A recorded educational presentation and a live Ask the Expert event in week four. If you're already a membership and you already are supporting us, we really appreciate your time and your money. If you want to join all of our efforts and all the things that we do so that we can keep all of the things, the Monday through Friday broadcast and the Monday through Friday posting on Substack free and available to everyone, please join us. Go to the membership tab at shoptenpenny.net. You'll find out all about the membership and everything else that we have available for you there. We want to make 2025 a big mix of free and membership content. Let's make this year a year of knowledgement, empowerment, and action. Thank you for your continued support. Again, if you go to shoptenpenny.net, the membership tab will tell you everything you need to know. And with that, before I introduce to you today's special guest, John Bowdwin, to talk about his books, The Real CDC COVID, Facts for Regular People, and his other book, The CDC Memorandum, A Notice of Criminal Liability, we're going to take a really quick break. You don't want to miss this interview. It's really over the top. We had a great conversation before we went live, and it's on fire and very timely. So sit tight. We'll be right back. Zeolite is a detox spray. We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use, and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant. You can take it when you're nursing. You can give it to little children. You can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out, the heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch with in our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years. Go to drtenpenny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off. Well, welcome back, everyone. John Bowdwin is a Christian, a father of three, a former semiconductor engineer with a BS in systems engineering. He also has a BA, an MBA in management. After losing his eldest son in 2018 in a tragic motorcycle accident, John found purpose in protecting children from harm. At the age of 56, he enrolled in law school to sharpen his ability to advocate for justice. And despite attending two semesters, he was unenrolled. He didn't drop out. He wasn't kicked out. He was just unenrolled due to his COVID-19 vaccination status. Undeterred, John now leverages his background in engineering, economics, morality, law, and philosophy to gather evidence and deliver truth to the people. His book reveals overcounted COVID-19 deaths, hidden vaccine fatalities, and data linking excess deaths to the 2021 vaccine rollouts. Presented in an accessible way, John's work is a call for accountability. That kind of goes along with my book that says zero accountability and justice for future generations. John, thank you so much for joining us at This Week with Dr. T. I feel like, we had our chat before we went live. I could talk to you for days. Thank you so much for joining us here this morning.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tenpenny. Like I said earlier, I have a lot of respect for the original people in this whole fight. I don't know. I can't think of whom I talked to before. That was one of the OG vaccine truth tellers. So thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, it's been a, God called me to action and said, you're the only person who's willing to do the work. And I said, okay. So I've been doing it for, in September, it'll be 25 years I've been doing this stuff.
Wow. Wow.
And I feel like some ways the needle hasn't moved. And I feel like some ways it has moved a lot. It seems like everywhere I go to every seminar and places, people are always thanking me for all the things I've done. It's just another day of work to me, just getting the truth out, which I think is where you started. When COVID started, you were evaluating CDC data and found the math just didn't work. What got you started in that direction?
Well, my, like you read, my, I lost my oldest boy, and my other two were, not, we're all depressed, not doing well a few years ago. I was sitting on the couch just watching TV for 2 years, and then COVID hit, and my middle son said, "Ah, it's all a bunch of BS." And so I said, "Well, you got to be a responsible citizen and do what's right." And I'm thinking in my head, doesn't seem right to me either. So I loaded the data. I found an error in the math of 2014 through 2018 data. I wrote to the CDC. They have an address that you write to if there's a problem with a file. So I wrote to them. I said, "Your pneumonia, influenza, and all cause are not adding up." So they took the file down, and when they put the file back up, they didn't change the math. They changed the data. And that, as an engineer, like, that's not right. You can't just change data because some guy from Medfield, Massachusetts wrote to you, but they did. And it was all about making 2020 look bad. Now, this was, we're only talking like 2 months into the pandemic. So that set me off. I started digging. And the more I dug, the more I realized they were lying about the racial aspect. Like, well, if you're using the entire nation as a denominator and saying Black people are 13% of the population, but it's 30 something percent of the COVID deaths, why are you adding Nebraska and Kansas and, North and South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming? COVID hadn't gotten there yet. It was really in the Northeast and in the cities and in the far West. So when I looked in areas like the five boroughs of New York, I wrote a paper on this, five boroughs of New York, Cook County, Illinois, which has Chicago, Northern New Jersey and Massachusetts. It was the same percentage of race by deaths. It wasn't any greater. So where COVID was, and that destroyed the narrative they were putting on the news. So then I looked at students, different ages, and I found out that everything they were saying was a lie on the news. I proved everything wrong. So that's how I started.
And you also, in your book, The Real CDC, grew out of an analysis of 420,000 death certificates in Massachusetts from 2015 to February of 2022. How did you obtain those death certificates?
Well, at first I thought I had to do a state FOIA. It's called a public records request in Massachusetts. But then they told me, "Oh, you don't even need to do that. Just ask for them." So I asked for them. So they gave me and they're non-redacted. I have everybody's first, middle, last names, the parents' names, where the parents are from, the burial plot, the medical examiner's license number, the doctor, physician attending at time of death, what hospital they died in, everything. I have everything. And what set me to do that, though, was a 7-year-old girl they said died from COVID. And I thought, yeah, there's no way that happened. I've been doing this for a couple of years now, and healthy children don't die from COVID. So I was looking for a death record. They wouldn't give me her one death record, but they gave us the entire database of the state from 2015 through 2022. Hey, I'll take it. And I don't know what their logic is. So, yeah, her death record actually said she died of COVID, but then I matched her with the VAERS record, and the VAERS record was pretty telling. 7-year-old girl, Massachusetts, within a week of the death record. So the child died on January 18, and the VAERS record was injected on the 13th of January, 5 days earlier. The first vaccine reacted in 5 minutes, vomited for 8 to 10 hours. So they gave her another one a couple of weeks later. And that one was terrible abdominal pain, 103 degree fever, didn't have a bowel movement for 3 days. The report ends on the 15th, and you cannot update a VAERS record. Cassidy Baraka died on the 18th. I have a lawsuit against Massachusetts governor, public health commissioner, chief medical examiner, and four individual medical examiners for not just that, but hundreds of fraud, records of fraud. And I'm asking, what's your vaccination date? The public needs to know. It's in the public interest. You can say it's private information, but you always say the public interest makes it so you want to vaccinate everybody. Well, how about if the vaccine's killing people? Isn't that in the public interest? Shouldn't we know whether the vaccine killed her? I know it. I know she was killed by the vaccine. Nobody's come to me. The principal, the superintendent of school, the vice principal, the nurse, all the teachers, they all know. Nobody said a word. They let everybody line their kids up for the vaccine to save them from COVID because the news, Channel 5, Channel 25, they all said she died of COVID. And the parents are nervous about their kids dying from COVID when it was the vaccine that killed her. That's how bad it is.
And that's true across the country, but certainly around the world. You know, you also said that 80 to 90% of deaths in Massachusetts were not from COVID. That's a shockingly high number, but really not surprising. What do you think the real cause was from the COVID jabs, correct?
It depends on when. So Massachusetts it's not unique, but it's very, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and New York are unique, okay? And the first wave in March to June of 2020, in that first wave. So it's going to be a little bit different here. But so here's what I found was, I have all the names. I looked up at Janice Gravetti, medical examiner, Robert Weldon, medical examiner, Julie Hull, medical examiner, Michelle Matthews, medical examiner, Massachusetts. I can tell you all of the deaths they certified and the number of COVID deaths they certified and what was co-resident on those death records. And when I see either nothing else listed, or if I see acute fentanyl overdose or blunt force trauma to the head, where the place of death was a stairwell at an old folks home, you have old ladies falling down the stairs getting blunt force trauma deaths. They tested the dead bodies for COVID. And so by looking at the percentage of, say, Janice Gravetti or Robert Weldon, I know that, you know, there's no pneumonia, there's nothing else on 80 to 90%. I say 80 to 90 because it's more toward 90, but it's it's in that range. And if I could take it across those and extrapolate, how many, if they're willing to put accidental deaths with blunt force trauma and acute fentanyl overdose, if they're willing to do that, what are they doing to old ladies 95 who die of a heart attack? COVID, 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 COVID. Everything's COVID. Beyond that, when you get into after November 2nd, 2020, you start getting into the hospital homicides where people are, they test positive. The first thing the hospital does in order to jack up the price is put them on remdesivir. And after remdesivir, then you've got the midazolam, lorazepam, dexmedetomidine, propofol, fentanyl protocol getting toward the ventilator. If you get on a ventilator, you end up with a lung infection. And then you go septic and they hit you with the vancomycin. So what caused the death and the acute renal failure? Was it COVID? Were they really deteriorating? Because I have records where they had 95% oxygen level, 15 breaths per minute, and they were put on a ventilator. There was no struggle breathing. You know, it's all incentivized. The CARES Act incentivized certain things. And the pay plan defines the behavior. I mean, that's how I grew up in business. We came up with pay plans in sales and marketing. If you want a certain behavior from them, you create certain incentives. That's what the CARES Act is. It changed the pattern of behavior and conduct of people in the healthcare industry. And they had papers to back it up. So they can, oh, we didn't do anything wrong. We have the research papers to back it up. There's a 11% better outcome if they get on remdesivir. It's like, well, are you counting the dead ones? Really? So that's, I think that answers your question.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, there were a couple things about the COVID testing that have never been answered. I mean, first of all, we should have never used PCR testing. Second of all, you know, we caught them with their hands in the cookie jar about setting the cycling records so high. I mean, when that first lab out of just south of Atlanta, when they had 100% of their swabs, 100% tested positive, which is just statistically impossible.
Yeah.
Impossible. And then COVID comes from a coronavirus, and coronaviruses have been identified and in circulation since the 60s. And every year, somewhere between 8 and 12% of influenza, that's named influenza, comes from coronaviruses. So on this, all of this testing that we did, and I said this widely and broadly during COVID, that we didn't have a pandemic of any sort of infection. We had a testemic. We had everybody getting tested and everything being positive. Did anybody anywhere along the line in your digging and your research ever differentiate between when you get a nasal swab and a test? Was it just garden variety coronavirus that's been out there since the 60s, as opposed to COVID, which was this genetically modified, synthetically made thing in a lab? Have you ever seen that they have really distinguished that anywhere? I'm assuming that they didn't, because who would fund that study? Because you can't find what you're not looking for. And if you don't want to know the answer, you're not going to put any money into studying it. But I've always had a curiosity about that and wondered, in your deep research, have you seen anything about that?
Well, I'm not an expert at anything. We talked about that earlier. I was on a lot of calls with actual experts, like Kevin McKernan. I trust what he says with regard to genetics because I haven't seen anybody that can go up against him with anything he doesn't already know. I'm sure he's not perfect, but he's my go-to guy for all the genetics stuff. To answer though, I mean, which I shouldn't do because I'm not an expert, but there were some specific tests, but those were not used widely. And they were only used in certain labs. And it's only a few people who know the result. Are you testing for the nucleocapsid versus the spike protein? What are you testing for with those genetic codes and sequences that you're looking for? It was all a scam. You're absolutely right. What they didn't do, Dr. Tenpenny, is more telling than what they did do. What they had the capacity to do without a lot of expense, but did not do, that tells you everything you need to know. They didn't look at most of the stuff that was easy to find, especially with regard to the vaccine deaths. And they can tell whether or not a person died from the spike protein is from the vaccine or from the virus. They can tell. They don't want you to know because it's from the vaccine. That's killing 100 times more people than the virus did. So.
That's so true about what they didn't do, what they could have done. Very early on in COVID, this would have been somewhere probably the end of March of 2020. I have a friend that owns a big interest in a couple of labs, and I called him and I said, "You know what we need to do? Let's develop a test to be able to test people for sensitivity to polyethylene glycol." Because polyethylene glycol is in, they say that 80% of the population has a sensitivity to it because it's used everywhere. It's in injectable products, it's in food products, it's on skin cream products. And if we can test people, like we could develop a little thing where they could do a finger stick and drop it on a pad and do little home testing, that they have sensitivity to polyethylene glycol, then they can get a legitimate medical exemption from having this because polyethylene glycol is part of the COVID jabs. And also there are a lot of infant vaccines that have polyethylene glycol in it. And I'm not a big fan of Wikipedia at all, but Wikipedia's page on polyethylene glycol is actually very good. It's very scientific and very thorough. So we talked about it, and he went to his lab and he talked to the director of the lab, and the lab said, "So that shouldn't be really hard to do." So they got some reagents and they started creating it. And then they had a test sample of 50 people that they tested. And sure enough, 80% of those people on a finger stick had a sensitivity to polyethylene glycol. And so we started like rolling into this business plan of how we could send, how what we could do with this. And of course, we could make some money off of it, but not much, because the whole idea was to be able to get legitimate medical exemptions from the COVID jab. And about 6 weeks into this whole plan that we were doing, he called me one day and he said, "We got a problem." I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "The reagent that we need to be able to do the test, my lab director can't find it anywhere now. And the only ways that we can buy it is in 55-gallon drums, and it has to be imported from outside the country, and we can't get it in through because of COVID, we can't get it into the country. Obviously, somebody had been listening to our conversations and they just shut the whole thing down. And it was so infuriating at one other thing, and on top of the many things and the laws they broke and all these other things, to poison the public. What do you think about this new paper that just came out from the White House? This, you know, what, 55-page paper or 500-page paper, identifying everything that we've all known all along about this whole thing. But because those of us that study it knew it, the rest of the people didn't. And because it's an official document from the White House, now they're saying, confirming the lab leak series, but they don't say anything about the COVID jab anywhere in it. I mean, to me, this release was just a big so what. I mean, I don't know if you've read it or read excerpts of it or anything like that. Do you have an opinion about that?
Yeah, the of course I have an opinion. I have an opinion on everything. Anybody who knows me knows that. But I think it means different things to different people. I think it's a good thing that it came out. it may not be what you want or what I want. It falls short, obviously. It's a rehash of what the Congress did, right? There's nothing new in there. What they're doing is saying what Congress did, but they're putting it on the executive branch's website. That's good. Why are they doing it? The best thing about that, I don't want to say it's the best thing, the most important. The United States did COVID to the world. It's in there. The culpability of what funded it is the United States. That's an admission. That's a very, very strong admission from the White House. Whether you believe it's a lab leak or if it was strategically deployed, you know, people know me. I believe the latter, and it took me a long time to get there. But I'm there. And I know things other people don't know. So, yeah, it's good. And it's why did they do it, though? They're setting up to do criminal prosecutions of certain people, or to point to them and say, see, that's why they got pardons. And they're going to try to pin it on certain people. You know, Fauci is one of them, right? And Daszak and so forth. I think it's a setup to have them be the fall guys for, you know, what happened with COVID. Even though Trump says it's China, now he can back off from the China thing and say, well, we had some bad people working with China. That's where they're going with it. It's a limited hangout in the definition of a limited hangout, perfect definition. But it's, hey, it's forward progress. I'm not going to, you know, I can complain it's not enough. And I do appreciate the people who push back. Like, that's not enough. We need more. Those people have to stay vocal. Like Shannon Joy, she's out there pushing the envelope all the time. You know, a lot of people don't like her because she's out there pushing hard on people. It moves the needle.
We've got to, you know, really put the screws to what's happened with these people that have gotten these jabs. 1.6 million VAERS reports that those people, and we know that VAERS only captures about 10% of injuries, and those people have been all thrown underneath the bus. You filed a report in the wrong place, number one, and number two, you have to file with the CICP within a year of your injury, and we're 4 years out of this. So they're not going to, so unless they retroactively do something to compensate these people for the sacrifice of their lives to this poison that should have never been on the market. And then the scary part is that the, you know, there are more than 18,000 physicians now worldwide that have joined a petition to stop the mRNA technologies. They are full steam ahead with that. And not only that, they're full steam ahead with the self-amplifying RNA, the saRNA, that is going to be even worse. I mean, where are the stopgaps in these things, John?
Yeah, you know, I look for root cause, right? The biggest root cause problem we have is the judicial branch. People don't realize that because they don't get attention. In most districts, you elect the executive and legislative branches, the governors, the president, the senators, state senators, representatives. Those are all elected officials. They get all the attention. But the problem is in the judiciary. They're basically taking over. they've used the rules of civil procedure to keep citizens out of court. And so if you bring something and you want an injunction saying, look at the number of people dying, look at what is happening. You can't take my rights because there's no difference in going to church versus going to all the protests that you allow. You know, all those cases are dismissed on standing, right? Or qualified immunity, sovereign immunity, standing, mootness, ripeness, laches. Those are reasons for cases to be dismissed. So you can't have a, it's in the court of equity versus a court of law. It's the same court, it's the same judge, but he's sitting in equity if he's making a decision for an injunctive. Injunctive relief is equitable relief, not law. Judges have to follow the law, but if there's no law about a specific situation, he has to sit in equity as a chancellor in chancery and make a fair and equitable decision for the two parties before him. And they have to balance, it's a balance of harms between the parties and taking into account the public interest. Well, the public interest in the case of a pandemic always comes down on the side of government because government's doing the right thing for the people, but it never gets tested. It doesn't get tested at a substantive level in a real argument with logic and facts because they dismiss you on procedure. That really is the root cause of what you described. It's the elections, it's the pandemic, it's vaccines, it's everything. Everything comes down to that. And when John Roberts came in 2005, there came two cases in 2007 and 2009. And those two cases changed everything. And they've been cited 30 times more than any other seminal case in the history of the United States. 300,000 citations for Ashcroft versus Iqbal and Bell Atlantic versus Twombly, which added another abstraction of you know, subjective whim of any judge to be able to dismiss a case, added on top of Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife from 92, which was the previous standing doctrine seminal case. 45,000 versus 300,000, and you've got 30 years versus 15 years. So it's huge. Yeah, I'm sorry to deviate onto law, but that's the problem in the U.S. That's the root cause problem for everything, elections, everything.
What did those two, I mean, as I'm not a lawyer and I don't know much about case law, and I'm sure a lot of my listeners don't. What did those two case laws you said in 2005 and 2009, what did they in essence say that you said sort of changed everything?
They said, if you don't have a plausible set of facts on the face of the complaint, you need a minimum number of facts, then it's not, you failed to state a claim. Failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted is Rule 12b6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. That's used all the time to kick people out, as well as 12b1, subject matter jurisdiction, 12b2, personal jurisdiction, and three is venue. But between 12b1 and 12b6, that's probably 95 to 99% of the case dismissals are based on that. And all the language is it's not a plausible claim on its face. Who decides if it's plausible? Well, the judge does. You know, and like I say, if his wife doesn't like the subject matter, you're out. If he has a golf outing that day, you're out. That's how bad it is now. And people keep looking, the lawyers keep looking at the law. Oh, I thought I stated enough facts. Oh, I'm going to have to go back to the drawing board and state more facts. He just doesn't want you in court. That's it. It's come down to the judges adjudicating based on not what's fair and equitable, but rather what their whim is.
You know, John, it's no wonder that they disenrolled you from law school. Could you imagine? What would you be doing if you would have gone all the way through law school? Did you go? I mean, you were there for 1 year. They disenrolled you because they didn't approve your COVID exemption. They didn't disapprove it. They didn't approve it. They just ignored it and said, you're not welcome here anymore, in essence.
Right. Yeah. And the case was dismissed on standing. Ashcroft versus Iqbal was cited. But I went to appeal. I represented myself against the law school at the a three-judge panel at the Massachusetts Court of Appeals, and I won. I'm back in to sue the law school. But and I did, you know, I had a few debates in class with the he's actually the dean of the school, but he was my civil procedures professor, and he didn't like the fact that I was pointing out to the class that the judges will do what they want. It doesn't matter what the rules are. You know, he's like, well, you're kind of cynical. I'm like, I'm just telling the truth. So we had a few debates. But I beat his guys in appeals court. We'll see what happens. Lawyers don't really understand the theory of law and how it meshes with civil society and morality and ethics within a society. They understand how the mechanisms of, a complaint, a motion to dismiss, an opposition memorandum, citing. They do all case research and legal citations, spend most of their time doing that in their early career. They don't really think like, what's really happening here? Is it an equitable decision or a decision at law? And I can patch together a bunch of incongruous case citations. In other words, I can take words from the cases that seem to fit my whatever case I'm working on and trying to put forth in the judge's mind. But when you look under the cases, you find they're completely incongruous. The situation was totally different, and it should have nothing to do with the case at hand. But you're patching together phrases out of case law to try to tell the judge, oh, this is the right thing to do based on case law. And it's terrible. Nobody's looking for justice or equity anymore. They're just looking to try to fool the judge. That's all it's about.
You think that did you go? I mean, you were in law school for 1 year, correct? Have you gone back and restudied and relearned as though you were a second or a third year law student? Because you really have a strong handle on this better than any lawyers I've talked to.
I think I can say I have a better handle when it comes to the intersection of law and economics, especially with regard to torts, and the value of torts in society to keep manufacturers from killing people. I have a 10-minute video that I made for that class that the professor told me to, everybody had to do a 10-minute video. He asked me to do it on economics. He said he didn't understand it and the students didn't understand it, so I should do it. So I did it on the PREP Act and the Liability Shield, and it's out there. It's on YouTube. If you look at the hand formula, and look for my face in the bottom corner of the video, the judge was called Learned Hand. That's his actual name. Learned, and LEARNED. His last name was Hand. It's kind of a funny name out of New York. So I have a different perspective because I went to law school at 56 years old with a lot of life experience, an MBA, understanding economics, finance, accounting, engineering, the physical world, having to take physics and chemistry and engineering and material properties. When they said masks work, I'm like, no, they don't. You're crazy. People say throwing sand at a chain link fence. Okay, but that's not what it is. If you throw lint at a lucite rod in the middle of winter with dry air, it's going to go sideways and defy gravity and touch that rod. People don't understand the static charge property of physics, and that's really how masks are supposed to work, but they don't work anyway. Yeah, so I hope I go back to law school someday. It doesn't look good. I'm 60 years old, and I don't think most of them will let me in anyway.
You know, it's interesting. I think that maybe all of us, myself included, when we go back to academia at a certain level when we're older, and you bring a whole set of life experience with you, you do things and you read things and you learn things completely differently. I have a really good friend who was a physicist for 20 years before he decided he wanted to go back to medical school. And when he went back to medical school, I mean, he just ripped them all apart. I mean, he did everything based on physics, and they didn't like him very much. And he's kind of like you. He's strongly opinionated, and he ran into a lot of brick walls just by, telling the truth of from combining disciplines and being able to show that. So we're going to take a really quick break here today. I mean, I think that John and I could do this interview for about 4 more hours, I think. But right now we're going to take a really quick break. Today I'm talking to John Bowden, who's talking. We haven't really talked that much about your books, The Real CDC COVID Facts for Regular People, and your CDC Memorandum, The Notice of Criminal Liability. There's much more to come, really. We could keep going on this for a long time. Come back. We'll be right back.
We also have an apparel line on our store
that has just the best things. In fact, I go and shop at my own store. I mean, I really do go and buy stuff out of my own store. They have t-shirts and sweatshirts and cups and mugs and totes. We've got a great designer. We're always adding new things all the time. And either one of those two product lines, either our private label supplements, our OptiLine, the white bottles with the green leaves on it, or with the apparel store, and they're two separate stores. They do not have a single shopping cart. It's like you go in one store and get your groceries and you go to the other store and get your shoes. Well, these are two separate stores, but you can use the same affiliate code. If you use the code podcast, when you go to the checkout, you can get 10% off on everything you buy every time you go to the store. Well, welcome back, everyone. John, let's go full circle back around to start talking about some of the things about your book. When you had mentioned before that myocarditis is only about 1% of vaccine-related, COVID-related deaths. You said that in an interview in February of 2024. A year later, do those numbers still hold, and is that still true?
Yeah, it's still true. Myocarditis is real, and it affects a lot of people. It goes unnoticed. And I do believe it's a very big problem. In fact, I stated 2-3 years ago that people are going to die 20, 30 years earlier than they otherwise would have, but they're not going to know it for 30 or 40 years. And it's not going to be attributed to the vaccine. If you scar something, it's less elastic. It's not going to last as long. And myocytes don't grow back. And you know more than I do. So there's that aspect. The other is, if somebody's a 4-minute, 30-second miler, they run the mile in 4:30, right? They may never be able to run that mile better than 4:50. They've decreased the performance, but only an elite athlete in the world is going to know they've decreased the performance of their heart. If you take a regular person, the only way they're going to notice it is if they come into a situation where they need peak performance, and then they could just drop dead because they can't hit that performance anymore, whether it's lifting a car off a person or, you know, just getting excited about something. They're just not athletes, so they might just drop dead. So myocarditis, yeah, it's 1% of the deaths, though, because a lot of the deaths haven't happened yet. The reason why I'm so bent on the myocarditis is because deaths involving acute renal failure, if you look at excess myocarditis versus excess acute renal failure, it's 150 times more than myocarditis, 150 times, and goes down into the teenage years. So, yeah, 150 times. That's how many people, 250,000 people, excess, more than normal, died from acute renal failure in the United States in the last 4 years. I don't know why people aren't talking about it. I don't get it. I mean, strokes are worse than myocarditis. Pulmonary emboli, far worse than myocarditis, like 30 times, right? When you go down the, even cancers, I can't remember the numbers. Like, ugh, trying to do the math in my head right now. I don't know, 8 times. I think it's around 8 times more. Oh, that's lymph node cancer. Sorry, that's specifically lymph node cancer. It's a lot. Everything is more than myocarditis. I believe that they selected myocarditis, they being whoever's in charge of social media promotion and suppression. They allowed those who were talking about myocarditis to have the platform, to have the ear of the people, because hardly anybody knows anybody who died of myocarditis. We see some in the news, but you don't know anybody down the street. And when somebody down the street gets kidney failure and you don't attribute it to the vaccine, nobody's told them that, yes, kidney failure is caused by the vaccine, in addition to the hospital homicides and protocols that occur with remdesivir and so forth. But I've had people tell me, oh, even now in 2025, even within the past couple of weeks, oh, thank you for telling me that the vaccine causes acute renal failure. I didn't know. Like, I've been saying it for 3 years. I can't get the word out there. And the doctors are all talking about myocarditis. And what that does is it plants in the mind of the viewer that it's extremely rare.
Hmm.
So that's the problem.
You know, when, was it 3 years ago now when Pfizer tried to get the FDA to suppress all the records, or the FDA just wanted to suppress the records for 75 years. And whoever that judge was says, no, I see through this. You want everybody to be dead that's culpable to be dead and gone before these get unveiled. No, you're going to release all of it. And so they started releasing it. And the first tranche that came out was a 38-page paper that the last 8 pages of that paper, single space lined across the page for 8 pages, was more than 1,200 conditions, side effects, diseases that were caused by the COVID jabs. And they knew this before they released it to the public. So because of that paper, I've said for all of these years, when people say, do you think that the COVID shots could cause X, fill in the blank? The answer is yes.
Everything.
Because they can cause everything. And that's part of the problem of the deniability, because instead of it being just one thing, it's every organ system has been damaged by the spike proteins and the mRNA self-replicating stuff. And so it doesn't surprise me that the myocarditis is less than that. That is a low number. But it does surprise me that the renal failure stuff is so high and that nobody's talking about it. Why do you think you can't get any traction with that?
Some people have told me I'm one of the top three suppressed people on X. A lot of my peers blew up to hundreds of thousands of followers pretty quickly. I guess somebody else told me that's on you. Figure it out. Figure out a way to reach people. The answer is I don't know, Dr. Tenpenny. I don't understand. I've got the Connecticut Memoranda Series Volume 1 out there. I served it to the Attorney General, the Governor, the Health Commissioner of Connecticut, walked down, got videotape, handing it to a lawyer for the Health Department of Connecticut. They do nothing. They do nothing with it. It's all documented. I even did a whistleblower report in the public auditors or the auditors of public records of Connecticut. They referred it to the Attorney General. I have the email. He's not going to do anything with it. There's no accountability at all.
Don't they, if you serve this to them, don't they have a legal responsibility to respond?
Yes, they do. But who's going to arrest him? The Attorney General? No, he is the Attorney General. You know, it's when the way you put that, let me phrase it for the audience. So when you have a legal duty to act, the omission of your action is criminal. If you're a lifeguard at a pool, you've been hired to watch the pool. If you watch somebody drown, knowing that they're drowning, and you don't help, that's not negligence. That's murder. So by telling him that his people are dying, telling the Attorney General and the governor, and they have a legal duty to protect the people. They took that job. They're the lifeguard at the pool. Somebody else could have that job, but they have that job. So they got to do their duty. Otherwise, it's a criminal omission of conduct.
Have you gone to the Attorney General in Missouri? I don't
know. I might have texted him or not texted. I might have emailed him at one time. I tried Missouri and Louisiana and the good states.
Good states, exactly. They have gotten some traction and they've moved forward. I mean, a good friend of mine is a personal friend of the Attorney General in Missouri. And, you know, he's one of the few that's willing to take all of these things on and sort of look at it. And I think that your data, because you say that it's worse than criminal fraud, it's actually felony murder.
Yeah.
It's what they need to be charged with. And this is your second book, the CDC memorandum, is a notice of criminal liability. And that the government has been served. I mean, have you tried to get to Pam Bondi?
No, not her specifically. When I say served, like the directors of the CDC, NIH, FDA, and 13 deputy directors were sent copies of the CDC memorandum. And I have the receipts. I put them online in a Substack. I know when when their offices received them. It's tough. Every attorney general in the country for every state is a political animal. They've left law enforcement and they've become a politician. And many of them have aspirations to be governor. They're not going to go against pharma. They go against pharma, their career's over. If you go to every state house in the country of every state, and you go to the health committee, whether it's Department of Public Health or Department of Health and Human Services, different states call them different things. But if you go to the committees, the Senate committee, the House committee of every state, they're taking pharma money. Everyone. How do you beat that? You know, I had a bill that I wrote, which I still think is the best public health transparency bill out there. It was in New Hampshire and Minnesota. And when I talked in New Hampshire, There was one person who asked me, well, can pharma get the data too? Like, yeah, there's no reason why they can't. I just want to make sure that the people have access to what is the health of the state. And the bill forced the states to provide to the people, what are people dying from? It's really simple. How many days from vaccination are people dying? It would force the state to put that report out. She wanted to make sure pharma got the data. And then I found out she's the one who killed the bill. She's the vice chair of the committee. And then I found out she has a degree in economics from MIT, and she was a stock trader. And then she became a stock analyst in, I believe, either biopharmaceuticals or biotechnology. Her career and all her professional ties are to the industry that she's supposed to be overseeing. And she killed the bill. I
I
was told, yeah.
remember years ago, this was probably somewhere between 15 and 20 years ago. We pushed really hard in the state of Alaska because there was a gal that I was working with that was in our health freedom movement, that her father had been a senator and she had been very involved in the public health arena in Alaska. And we introduced and tried to get a bill passed up there that with every child that dies, particularly under the age of two, that their vaccination record would be just stapled to the death certificate, so that in the event that anybody wanted to go and do some sort of a correlation study, they could see that there was a correlation or there wasn't. You know, I mean, what better way for them to prove that there was no correlation than to have the data there? And we worked for about 4 years and never could get that to get any traction. You
That
know.
exact thing is a line in my bill.
Oh, really?
Yes,
Wow.
it is. If for any child under 2 years old who dies, their entire vaccine history is to be put in a field on their death record.
You know, this is one of the things that we've talked about. In fact, we tried to do it three times, is that to have a legitimate debate between pro-vaccine people and educated anti-vaccine people. And the most recent one was probably, I think, I'm not sure what year that was. I'm going to say it was about 2017 or 18 in Atlanta. We had set up this thing called One Conversation. And it was going to be a group of eight people that were in the anti-vaccine movement and eight people from Emory and various places that supported the pro-vaccine thing. And they had all agreed to it. We had a professional moderator set up that was a television guy of a local television station there. Everybody was to get their questions in advance and they had time to prepare them. So there wasn't any gotcha stuff that was going on. It was just, you talk. You talk, you talk, you talk. And then we were just going to record it and then let the people decide. It was all set up, ready to go. We all flew down there. And the night before, we were supposed to do this thing I believe it was on a Saturday or something. Everybody on the pro-vaccine side dropped out. They all got pressure. They threatened to lose their funding for their research. Some of them were professors, and they said, you're going to give these people a reason to believe there's something debatable because we know that the debate's over and we've won. And so we just had the event anyway. And what we did on this big stage, there was all of us sitting over there. And on the opposite side, there were just chairs, like the same chairs that we had. And there were little signs in each one of the chairs that said, no show. And we had the debate anyways, but it's because they don't have anything to stand on. Nothing they can bring to the plate has any validity.
You use the term anti-vaxxer, and you know they changed the, you know there's a definition, and they changed the definition of that a few years ago. Yeah,
No.
no, they, you know how they changed the word vaccine? They changed the definition of that so they could call the mRNA gene drug therapy a vaccine. They also changed in dictionaries the term anti-vaxxer, which used to be somebody against vaccines. Now it's somebody against vaccines or against any government order having to do with any vaccine or any one vaccine. You could be against one vaccine, you're an anti-vaxxer, or you could be against any rule the government puts out having to do with vaccines, and you're an anti-vaxxer. They've increased the scope. I don't like to use the word because of that, but also because I say I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I'm only against vaccines that are harmful. And if that makes me an anti-vaxxer, that's on you. If they're all bad, that's not my fault. Don't call me an anti-vaxxer. I just want something safe. And if you can't make it safe, then I don't want it.
Yeah, well, we started a little mini campaign at the beginning of the year saying that, you know, instead of looking at the disparaging comments about being an anti-vaxxer, we need to wear it as a proud label, because it means that you can read, you're actually literate, you can think critically, you can express your position clearly, and you don't like to poison children. And the pro-vaxxer is just the opposite of that. You don't read, you don't think critically, you can't express your position and have anything to stand on, and apparently you like to poison children. And that was another thing that I decided about 6 weeks ago. I said, I'm never going to talk about the pediatric vaccination schedule again. From now on, I'm going to call it what it is, the pediatric poisoning schedule, that we poison children in the womb, at birth, and every 2, 4, and 6 months, 1 year and 5 years of age, that by the time they are 5 years of age, they've had about 40 doses of poison. And if you can prove to me that in somehow giving them 40 doses of poison somehow improves their health, okay, I'll go with it. Of course they can't, you know, of course they can't. Oh my gosh, John, we have so many things to actually talk about here. My list of questions that I had prepared for this interview, I've got 20 more that we haven't even gotten to here. What do you think is going to happen with RFK at HHS? And do you think that between him and Dr. Oz and Dr. Makari and Jay Bhattacharya, do you think there will be any substantive changes into the criminality of what happened during COVID, and all the data that you've exposed, and all the data that Naomi Wolf exposed in her book, you know, the Pfizer papers? Do you think that there will be any forward movement with that?
Forward movement, yes. Not to the extent that people like you and I would like. I think he's working within the parameters that he's allowed to work, RFK Jr., that he's allowed to work in. If he goes off the reservation, not what we would say, but what maybe Trump's people would say, he'll be fired in a minute, right? His job will be gone in a minute if he comes out and says they're killing people with the vaccines, it's over. I think what he's doing is the right way to do it in terms of what he's, you know, within the scope of being able to keep his job and move forward, and that is to do a study that's never been done before. The autism comment I'm talking about right now. I know people are upset, and we're killing people every day with the COVID jabs. Children are dying every single day. And yeah, we want to make it stop. But that's up to public opinion to make that happen. If you want the federal government, somebody like RFK Jr., it doesn't matter, put anybody in there. If you want them to stop it right away, public opinion has to be there. Yeah, so I don't know how to answer your question other than, yeah, there will be forward movement. There won't be as many prosecutions as people want, although there should be. I don't know if they're going to say, oh, well, Fauci has a pardon, but we can prove that he did it, and everybody should point to him and say, bad, bad guy, but he has a pardon, so we can't do anything. They could do that, but at least it'll be an admission, and all the Fauci is a saint people can go crawl back in their holes and get real and start thinking. I have a joke with a friend of mine who's talking critical thinking. Everybody's critical thinking. I used to cut the alligators off my shirts because I don't like to follow everybody else, right? When I was a kid. It's just thinking. There's no reason to put critical in front of it. People just need to think. Just think. There's so many lazy minds. They want to be told what to think. They don't want to think.
Well, it seems as though with all the data that you've put together through your two books, the CDC book and the memorandum, and all of the collated data that Naomi Wolf has put together in her Pfizer paper book, have you read her book?
Or no, no, I'm sorry, I haven't. No,
you should get a copy of it. It's really well done. It's they took the 450,000 pages of released and they collated it into things. There are mRNA pictures, there's slides. It's an oversized book. It's kind of heavy. And they put an enormous amount of detail into that. And Ed Dow's books on, you know, Died Suddenly and how he's still crunching numbers and how the numbers are still continuing. Between the three of you, with all the data and all the numbers that you've put together, it seems as though somewhere you should be able to get traction with all of this.
Yeah, actually, when I had talked to Ed, I don't know how long ago, he told me to write the book, you know, because, and I know, so Carlos Alegria and Yuri Fonseca Nunes in Portugal, they're finance technologies with Ed. And I spoke to them more than I spoke to Ed, especially Carlos. Got Carlos and Ed and Yuri to put out a paper on the acute renal failure. And we released it at the same time. It was a dual kind of, we timed the release, get two different groups coming out with the same information. He did the United States. I have records now for Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Minnesota. And so I've got three states that comprise about 5% of the US population. It's pretty substantial. And I now have 1.6 million death records. It shows it. And he said, the USA shows the same thing. Nothing happened. Nobody paid attention. I'm going to try. I mean, we'll try, you know. Ed Dow does the insurance data, very large aggregated data. Great stuff. I have three states, well, really four, but Vermont only has 600,000 people. So I tend not to talk about it. And they don't have ICD-10 codes. So I have to look for words like pulmonary embo and strings, character strings, in order to create statistics out of it. But anyway, and then Ethical Skeptic does a really good job too. As far as big data, those are the three. As far as individual records, where I believe the evidence really lies, the conclusive evidence is at the individual records. And I have a lot of individual death records, but those are only where to look in individual hospital records. The hospital files are where the evidence is. And it would take 2 weeks with, you know, three or four doctors to find enough evidence to destroy both remdesivir and the vaccine. That's all it takes. And you look at a 12,000 page medical record, which I have one that's 12,000 pages. I created a timeline. I've got the vital signs every hour while she was in the hospital, daily blood labs, medications to the minute they were received, imaging to the hour that it was done. And you build a timeline and you can see, you know, when did the levels of, you know, liver and kidney function, glomerular function, I forget how to pronounce that. You know, creatinine levels, liver enzymes, you've got all that. And you can build the timeline. When did they go bad? Did they go bad after remdesivir, after the vaccine, after vancomycin? You can figure it out. And through that forensic analysis, that's how it needs to be done. I have a method that I proposed to Dr. Latipo in Florida, and I'll talk to any state. It's top-down investigation, bottom-up quantification. The only way to determine causality, you can find anomalies at high-level aggregated data, and you can drill down what was the cause, what was the gender, what was the age group. And by the time you find out, like, pulmonary emboli were very anomalous in 18 to 44-year-old males. Well, now I've got my 60,000 records down to 300, and I can have three or four doctors look through the medical records of those 300 people within a few weeks, and we can determine what caused it. And once you have the cause, then I can go back up through the hierarchy, bottom-up quantification, and say, okay, now the excess pulmonary emboli deaths, now that we know the cause, and we know they started right at this point, we can attribute pulmonary emboli deaths in Massachusetts in 21 and 22 alone were in excess of 500. 500. Arrhythmia was 400.
Has Joe Latipo taken a look at this yet?
No. He had me talk to his chief epidemiologist, and she's a PhD epidemiology, and they have their ways. And I, you know, you don't have time for me to go into inferential statistical methods versus engineering methods and time domain and frequency domain analysis. And, you know, they try to put everything in a unimodal, one mode. Everybody knows what bell curve is, right? One mode. So the way I explain part of the problems with epidemiologists is they talk about p-values and confidence intervals. It's all based on a bell curve and a normal distribution. Male cancers I use as an example, right? Testicular cancer, mean age is 30. You get it from like 18 to 40. You're not going to get it after 40. That's testicular. Prostate cancer, you're not going to even look at it until 50. And even then, it's very few. It goes up with age. You have two different modes, a mean of 30 and a mean of, say, 70. And in between there, 40 to 50, there's a very low probability you're going to have either one. But if you take all the data, you throw it in a pool, and you say, give me the mean, which is generally the most likely that it's going to occur, and say, oh, it's 50. Male cancer is 50. Like, no, that's very low probability of either one because you've got a bimodal distribution. These are the problems with epidemiology, where they don't look at confounding variables. They don't look at multiple things like that and probability distribution functions. You just can't peanut butter everything into a normal distribution. It's wrong. And I talked to one of the really famous guys, and he said, well, you could use a Poisson distribution. You're just making the problem worse. You can't. Okay. I've talked about math enough. I'm boring the heck out of your audience.
No, I think it's really, really interesting because it's not anything anybody ever talks about. And maybe, you know, some of the phrases and the terms that you use may be over people's heads, including mine. But to know that there's things out there that can be done is really frustrating. You know, we've got just a couple of minutes left, John. How would you like to conclude our time that we've spent together today? Again, honestly, I could continue this conversation for about 3 more hours because it's so interesting and so fascinating to me. What would you like to leave with our audience today?
Oh, boy. You know, well, there's always hope. I'm concerned about people who are now realizing that they took a poison. I went to lunch with some guys, and the vice president where I worked, he just died of fast-acting pancreatic cancer. And I'm like, I know he got the jab. He had thyroid and diabetes problems. So I'm sure he took his boosters. The guy across the table says, oh, that's really funny. My former coworker just had the same thing. Got pancreatic cancer, died in a few months. And then the guy next to him said, yeah, my wife has autoimmune issues. John, do you think they're the vaccine? I said, I'll be right back. I went out to my car. I got books. And I signed the books. I gave them to all the guys I used to work with 20 years ago because that I hadn't seen them in 15 years. So I would say to people who are worried, don't worry. You know, worry about that which you can control. Go on with your life. People who are injured, I wish I had something for you. But if you want to know the truth, if you just want to know the truth and how to engage with family members who won't listen, then this book here is for regular people to read. And it has, like a guy at the gym said, John, I've never read anything like this. He said that this is not a book, it's an indictment. And you nailed it, because nobody can refute what you've done. I show you the names of the people, the records that they lied about, the fraud that they did. The Massachusetts even came back and put the vaccine on somebody's death, Breonna McCarthy's death record. It took them 3 years of the parents hounding, me writing 2 books, and a lawsuit against the state. And they finally added the vaccine as a cause of death to her death record, where they told everybody it was COVID for 3 years. So I don't know. Buy my books, I guess. TheRealCDC.com. It's above my head there. It's right up there. Really, really easy to remember. So I appreciate you having me on. I wish I could help more people. That's why I'm doing this. I just want to get the word out. Don't take any vaccines. None of them. I didn't come at it from this angle. I was not with you, Dr. Tenpenny. I just wanted to live my life and be left alone. They're killing kids. I know the parents of the kids. It gets me upset.
Yeah, well, John, your work will not go unrewarded. And it's just a matter of time until enough people learn about this and enough people put money behind it, enough people put effort behind it to get real accountability, because there is no accountability. I mean, that's the title of my book that just got released this week, Zero Accountability in a Broken System, because that's what it is. There's no accountability for any of this stuff. And it goes back many, many years. It didn't just start in 2020. the end of 2020 when the COVID shots came out.
Oh, can I say one more thing? I'm sorry.
Sure.
So people need to realize that Massachusetts is the center of a lot of this. We have 600 pharmaceutical companies, ecosystem companies, $47 billion in venture capital financing, 50 companies over 100 million a year, 10 companies over $1 billion a year. Moderna's headquarters and R&D is in Massachusetts. Pfizer's divisional headquarters for mRNA is in Massachusetts. Rochelle Walensky is from Massachusetts. She went from Mass General Brigham, that's the biggest hospital chain in Massachusetts, $20.6 billion a year they do. $4.5 billion from MassHealth, $4.1 billion from Medicare, $1.2 billion from Medicaid, $2.5 billion in research and academic. They get $1.12 billion. They're the largest recipient of NIH grant funding. Sorry, California. I heard somebody say California said that they were number one. But if you add up, they forgot to add up the line items, which is Mass General Hospital, Brigham and Women's Hospital, Spalding Rehab Center, Newton and Wellesley Hospital. When you add them up, by far, about 25% more than Johns Hopkins, Mass General Brigham. Walensky goes from sitting on the board of Mass General Brigham to being the CDC director, and instantly there's vaccine mandates across the country, and they're using CMS.gov out of the same under RFK now, but back then, CMS, FDA, NIH, CDC. Okay. They're using CMS, which is Medicare, Medicaid, to twist the arms of the hospitals to force all their staff to get vaccinated, who then have in their brain, oh, I have to make sure everybody else gets vaccinated. They start forcing all the patients, and you have all of society with mandates and companies. And there's a lawsuit in Massachusetts for Mass General Brigham. You mentioned the peg allergy. What they did to Tyler Adams, she was 800 miles away. She lives 800 miles away. It's fully remote. They fired her for not getting the vaccine. And she has a documented peg allergy that she submitted to the company. And they told her, you're fired or you can get the vaccine. After knowing she has a peg allergy that she could die from, they're trying to kill her. And because that she wouldn't get it, they fired her. That's just one example. These are evil people, and they needed to hit a quota so they could get their CMS money, Medicare, Medicaid. It's all tied together. Massachusetts is the center of it. Lindsey Bodden is the guy who ran the 30,000 person phase three clinical trial for Moderna. It's all connected. He's with Mass General Brigham. We believe that the guy that promoted, I think there's a three-person panel. He led the panel. They recommended the use of ventilators in March of 2020 to the CDC, which then became part of the protocol. How many hundreds of thousands of people did this guy kill? Mass General Brigham is the center. Massachusetts is the center of not just the vaccines, COVID, all of it, the papers they wrote. I'll stop now, but Dr. Tenpenny, if you look into it, that's the center of everything worldwide. Comes back to Massachusetts and Mass General Brigham.
That is quite an indictment, John. And I really, really hope that people really hear it, because it's time for us to get back to our constitutional republic and get rid of this fascist government that's run by these big monolithic agencies and the pharmacia that has a stranglehold on all of us. So with that, I want to close out today and say a special thanks for you for being here with us today, John, and putting all this on the table. We can do this again. We can do this as many times as necessary to get this information out to people, because it's really, really important. And I want to thank our Tenpenny Prime membership and all of our other members for supporting us. Your monthly or yearly support is what allows us to bring you these great interviews 5 days a week and all of the wonderful posts that we do on our Substack. So with that, I want to close out with one of my favorite verses from the Bible. I close all of my podcasts with, whether they are live or pre-recorded, which is Romans 12, 12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until the next time, remember to lean into God, trust Him for everything. He'll never let you down. And get some muscle behind this. Help us to get this word out, spread it out, take this video and share it with as many people as you know. And because people need to be held accountable. So with that, I want to thank you, John, again for being here this week, and for everyone else, goodbye and God bless.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.